And good morning. Welcome to another edition of Quest Community Vibration. And I want to start out our program by saying lyrics, like poetry, has a message. And history, like a diamond, can shine clear to the truth. Words have meaning that we can comprehend, like definition. News creates a chain of events that we may not always understand. Now pull back the curtain and see the contribution, and you will find our Quest moment where we attempt to make waves. So thank you again for joining us this morning, where you will have the opportunity to hear a different perspective that concerns you and our diaspora. And without any further ado, I would like to introduce our host, Mr. Shelton Harris. Good morning, Mr. Harris.
Good morning. Good morning to everyone.
All right. And I was noticing, like, the last couple of days that there's been a lot of conversation about what Ice Cube was talking to our president about this black agenda. And, you know, and I was noticing also that a lot of the stuff he was asking for, we kind of asked for these things in the past. You know, we get promises after promise and nothing would ever really coalesce where we can get something that's going to be beneficial for our community. And our chain of events for today, which I must say is just an interpretation of the news as it affects our communities in Newark and other communities, it's a report on the events in politics, education, law, and science, but it's really an interpretation of one event to another so that the listener can see what's going on. Today, I'm going to try to equate some of the promises and stuff that's been made that are being asked for today to some of the promises that's been made in the past. There was a well-known brother, at least to me, named Oscar Brown Jr. And he wrote a poem about promises and promises unrequited. It's called 40 Acres and a Mule. And this is an open letter that was pressed into my hand by a man from my street. If I'm not mistaken, I once read during the short time I spent in school, where every slave set free was supposed to get, for slaving, 40 acres and a mule. Now, ain't no telling how much work was done by my ancestors under slavery's rule, but sure enough, the total got to run at least 40 acres and a mule. Now, I'm not saying this to see folks sweat, because I ain't bitter or neither am I cruel. But ain't nobody paid for slavery yet. About my 40 acres and my mule. We had a promise. It was taken back. And when we hollered, it was like, hush, be cool. Well, for me, I'm being rowdy, hot, and black. I want my 40 acres and my mule. Don't tell me to get myself upset. Don't look at me like I'm some kind of ghoul. Just answer quietly. When do I get my 40 acres and my mule? No thanks, I'll take myself out to lunch. No thanks, I'll dig my own swimming pool and lay and play around with my own bunch if I get 40 acres and a mule. Because interest got to go on just like rent. I may be crazy, but I ain't no fool. 100 years of debt at 10% per year, per 40 acres, and per mule. Now add that up. Ooh-wee, look at here. No wonder we call great-grandma Jewel. Just pay me that and we'll call everything square. Yes, Lord, 40 acres and a mule. I love that poem because it said a lot. And, you know, it was kind of comical the way he was presenting it. But you can tell he was very serious. 40 acres and a mule.
Well, when I hear that, I don't think it's comical at all, especially when we talk about the issue of reparations. But let me have Ms. Gardner, are you on the line? Walter, are you on the line?
Yes.
Your interpretation... Yes, your interpretation of the poem, Walter.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, he was talking about, I know the biggest thing that stand out to me was the 40 acres and the mule, but I want to present a question just to get clarification to Mr. Harris. And my question would be, what was the, like, why was the word 40 acres and a mule constantly repeated in the poem? Just to clarify.
Okay, all right. After the Emancipation Proclamation, Abraham Lincoln, one of the compensations for making us work for nothing for a few hundred years was that he would give, because the country was still young, and we hadn't expanded as far out west as we had done later. But there was a lot of land in America, so they said, okay, we're going to compensate every slave with 40 acres of land and a mule so they can work the land and be able to be prosperous as a individual unit. But he was killed, like, soon after that. And the next president, Andrew Johnson, was really from the South, and he was kind of pro-Southern, pro-slavery. So a lot of the positive things that came out of the Emancipation Proclamation, he kind of reversed. And that's been like a battle cry for like a lot of people who had to go through all that. That, you know, where's my 40 acres and a mule? Because, like, as of now, we have, you know, America's just like, forget it when it comes to any kind of reparation for our time as slavery. But they've also given a lot of other groups reparations for their inconvenience. They gave the Japanese, when they had the internment camps during World War II, that was only for a couple of years, they compensated them. They were even compensating the Jews for the Holocaust, and we didn't even do nothing to them. You know, but it was just a way to look at things in a different light, and like, when are we going to get what you promised us? That's why I believe he kept repeating 40 acres and a mule, because if we was going to use that today, 40 acres and a mule today, that's a lot of money, because the average house is only like a third of an acre, if it's that much. Imagine having 40 acres. That's worth a lot of money now. And it's like, where are you going to get it from? Did that help?
It did. I appreciate you for answering my question. And also, I hope to clarify things for the audience. And, yeah, that was a very good poem. And now I understand why the word was kept repeated even more. So thank you.
All right, cool. So, moving right along? Yes. Yeah, so moving right along. You know, as we were talking about before, curtains is something that we do to hide what we're really seeing. But normally that's the case, but we use it as an exposure and analysis. Excuse me. Of artists and their work behind the curtain and the stage. Many artists and companies have grown rich from their support of the community, but what benefits have the community gained from those artists? Today, we pull back the curtain on John Roger Stevens. He was born in December 1978 in Springfield, Ohio. He's an American songwriter, a pianist who achieved success in the early 21st century with his R&B and soul music fusion. He also was a sought-after session musician. He was the first African-American man to win all four major entertainment awards, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. You know, Stevens was born into a musical family of working-class, gifted musicians. His mother directed the church choir, while his grandmother played the organ, his father and brother played the drums in the church. And he took up piano lessons at a young age and sang in the choir at church. His parents homeschooled him for several of his elementary school years. And after he graduated from high school, he went to the University of Pennsylvania. After graduating, he moved to New York City, where he worked for Boston Consulting Group by day and enjoying piano and singing in nightclubs at night. He also sold self-produced CDs during that time. In 2001, he was introduced to an up-and-coming producer named Kanye West and became a contributing keyboard music and background vocals by other artists, among them Alicia Keys, Talib Kweli, and the Black Eyed Peas. During that time, he adopted the name John Legend. Legend was with Kanye on his debut album, The College Dropout. After West formed his own label at Sony Music, the first album he produced was John Legend's debut album, Get Lifted, which had a song most people might remember called Ordinary People that really helped the album rise up the pop in R&B charts. It also got 8 Grammy Award nominations and won for Best R&B Album, Best Male R&B Vocalist. In addition, he took the award for Best New Artist. His second album won him praise as well as Legend's second Grammy nomination for Best R&B Male Vocalist and Performance. He was a co-winner with Josh Stone and Van Hunt for the Best R&B Performance by a Duo or a Group for his rendition of Simon & Family Stone's A Family Affair. In 2017, he co-produced August Wilson's Jitney on Broadway, and he received a Tony Award when the drama was named Best Play Revival. The following year, he played a title role in receiving a telecast on the 1970 rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar. As co-producer, he garnered a Creative Awards Emmy Award, and the show was for the Best Variety Special. With that honor, he completed the what they call the EGOT. In 2019, he became the coach in television singing competition, The Voice. But Legend also won praise for his philanthropic efforts. In particular, his work to improve educational opportunities for poor communities. He established the Show Me campaign to raise required funds to serve needy African villages. Rather than giving out the money to destitute villages, the Show Me campaign and Millennium Promise, which he co-founded, were more practical. They provided mosquito nets to curb the millions of avoidable deaths from malaria, free meals to children attending school, which raised attendance rates and health, safe water spots, local clinics, and fertilizer to provide crop production and eradicate food shortages. You know, and his philanthropic and outreach to causes for community empowerment was extensive, to name a few. The ACLU of Southern California, the Artists for Peace and Justice, the American Foundation for AIDS Research, the Can Do Organization, Get School Foundation, Girl Up, Global Citizen, Grammy Foundation, International Rescue Committee, the NAACP, The One Drop, Peace by Day, Planned Parenthood. You know, needless to say, the brothers understands the adage that for those who much is given, much is required. And that's my curtain for today.
Okay. One of the things that I kind of made a mistake there. Tanisha, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay. My apologies. But first of all, I would like to get your input on Mr. Harris from his poem that started out the program today, 40 Acres and a Mule. Any comments or questions?
I guess it would be a comment for the 40 Acres and a Mule. I don't know, it's very deep, you know, coming from the time frame of what our ancestors went through that time and to now. It's like we should take all the lessons that our ancestors went through and pay forward and start, like you said, buying property. We start reinvesting in our communities. I guess you see it throughout generations and generations, because when you study like certain, like due to certain migrations, they did do it. But it was like, for instance, with Tuscaloosa, Oklahoma, how powerful it was, but then they turned around and bombed it. So it's like, it's not like we don't take these strides to do it. It's how do we protect ourselves when the establishment comes against us. And we have to remember whatever empire that you're living in, that's the empire that rules. So how do you uplift yourself? You know, and I think it's some serious questions that has to be asked, because no one's going to give you anything. So as a community, how do we strengthen, you know, our allies to make sure that we are getting what we need? Because this is a world event, and it's like how do we connect everyone from a world diaspora, you know, as Black and Brown communities that we are in it, you know, and I guess not to make it a race war, because you know, even with them, they you know, with Europeans, they were suffering also. So right now it's like it's a class war that's going on. So if we could all uplift everyone together, that would be very powerful.
Now, Mr. Harris, I know you just got finished doing John Legend, but I want to give you a chance to respond to what she just said.
Now, well, see, I agree wholeheartedly, because the whole idea about survival and freedom is that it has to be a continuous effort. We can't just say, well, they didn't do it, so it can't be done. We have to step up. Every generation needs to step up and be able to do things that it takes to further us towards our goal. You know, we got to stop looking at leaders and start looking at the plan. You know, the leader can die, but the plan continues. This is what we need to this is what we need to do. And it sounds like coming from a sister. Well, she's obviously younger than me, you know, but it sounds good that the generations after me are still considering those things and are doing things to make those type of things happen. It's wonderful.
Okay. Of course, I had a smart remark when you mentioned something about age, but I'll table that nonsense so that we can continue.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and that's what's most important. We're happy. We're honored. You know, it is our honor to have you here. Walter, John Legend, you want to chime in? Any questions or comments?
I guess I have a comment on John Legend. Really, with, you know, he's somebody who's like, I guess you could say, kind of my generation, but he's such a good artist that he could like tap into just a lot of different generations, and he's very successful with just a lot of different people. His music is great. I listened to a couple of songs. He had actually one great song for the movie Selma, which is titled Glory. And just the things, it's always good to hear about people like him who make amazing music and just able to help and give back to people in need is always something that I just love of a person, that they could do both, and it just makes them an even better person. So that's what I'm going to say.
What do you think about John Legend? And your TV's up in the background kind of loud.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm in the line. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
I guess John Legend, what did he do with the – with Planned Parenthood?
Oh, he was more of a contributor to like the cause, because they're really under attack a lot now, and you know, for some obvious reasons, there's some good reasons to attack it, there's some bad reasons, you know.
Oh, okay.
Planned Parenthood's inception, Margaret Sanger, she had a different idea of what Planned Parenthood was, as opposed
to what
Planned Parenthood is trying to do now.
Yeah,
so
I'm so happy you brought up that point, because that's the main, that's what I was thinking about, Margaret Sanger, and how they was doing a project with the eugenics. And it just seemed like it's the same repetitive thing, especially like with the COVID. It's like they want to experiment with the vaccines. And it's like, what do? You want us to trust us, but then the flip side, as a snake does not change its nature. So how do you expect us to trust you? So that's what it kind of makes me think of. It's like, yes, they do all these great accolades, but even a devil could smile on your face. So it's just like, what do you do, you know? And I guess, I don't know, I guess actions speak louder than words. Yes, you could do nice things, but in the back of it, how do we truly uplift the community? Because music is very powerful. Music, it persuades you. It can shift you from one energy to the next. And what messages are they giving out here? And how can we truly uplift our community? You know, so it just makes you think about all these artists that's out here and how can we truly, work with them to truly bring up the community and move them forward in a positive way and in a strong way. So it's a lot to be taken in.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Walter, our student host, I want to ask you to chime in and take it away.
Yes, and again, I will be doing two diamonds today. Before I do those diamonds, I would like to read the intro. See, history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply, and you are bound to find yourself. And the first diamond of today will be Elaine Locke. And Elaine Locke is also known as a Black scholar. Elaine enjoyed helping people. It made him feel good to help others succeed. He especially liked to help those who were creative. Many aspiring writers and artists looked to him for encouragement and assistance. Elaine was an educator, writer, historian, and critic. He wrote many books and articles that helped people understand the contributions made by Black Americans to American culture. In 1907, he became the first Black person selected as a Rhodes Scholar. The Rhodes Scholarship is awarded only to a few standing students each year. Elaine was one of the leaders of the Harlem Renaissance during the 1920s and 1930s. At first, people recognized only Black writers. Elaine helped them make aware of Black artists and musicians, too. For 36 years, he taught at Howard University. Elaine was one of America's brightest scholars. And I just wanted to give y'all a little background on him, but I actually went into more about this Renaissance, this Harlem Renaissance that everybody's saying he was the leader of. And I'm looking at it, and it's just that's what his career was based around. That's what his probably biggest accomplishment was, dealing with the Harlem Renaissance. And if you don't know what the Harlem Renaissance is, the Harlem Renaissance is a blossoming of African-American culture, particularly in the creative arts and the most influential movement in African-American history, embracing literacy, musical, theatrical, and visual arts. Participants sought to reconceptualize the Negro, part of the white stereotypes that have been influenced Black people's relationship to their heritage and to each other. Now, Elaine Locke, the reason he's so big around the Harlem Renaissance is because he was dubbed the father of the Harlem Renaissance. And the reason he was dubbed and given that title was because all of the pieces he has wrote and promoted on other things about the Harlem Renaissance. He talked about the people and promoting Black people during that time, during the Harlem Renaissance, that was a key contributor to that and a key contributor for civil rights for Blacks. People like Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes, he would talk about in his writings. And one of his most famous books, The New Negro, you know, he talks a lot about the musical and art during the Harlem Renaissance. And that right there is just, it's just what helps move along and helps promote and tell people about our culture. Because, you know, being in America, our culture can sometimes be confused and people could think, oh, this is, they don't really have a culture. They share a culture with white Americans or Europeans, but actually we have our own culture. And during this Harlem Renaissance, it was greatly expressed with all these new arts pieces and music, dancing, just everything, literacy as well. So before I let everybody chime in who has any questions, I wanted to read a quote from The New Negro and one other quote. The quote says, "It must be increasingly recognized that the Negro has already made very substantial contributions, not only in his folk art and music, especially, which has already found appreciation, but in larger, through humbler and less acknowledged ways." And lastly, probably if you're going to make a comment, I probably want to also have you talk about this quote and what this means to you. And the quote reads, "The pulse of the Negro world has begun to beat in Harlem." And that was another quote from his book, The New Negro. And now I'm going to open up the floor to everybody who wants to say something.
Okay, so we're going to try to see if we can get Ms. Garner to chime in first. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, hello?
Were you able to comprehend? Yes, were you able to comprehend Walter and his diamond and his quotes at the end?
Some of it, you could read the first one again?
Yes, I could. And the first quote says, "It must be increasingly recognized that the Negro has already made very substantial contributions, not only in his folk art and music especially, which has already found appreciation, but in larger, through humbler and less acknowledged ways."
Yeah, yeah. That quote is very powerful, because when you look at America and how America came to be, without us, America wouldn't be here, especially with our native indigenous ancestors. And when you think about America and how America started, they took a lot of our symbols from ancient Egypt, like, for instance, with the eagle and also with the all-seeing eye, because that came from us. So for him to say such a remarkable statement, just the legacy of who we are is embedded in the, it's embedded and ingrained in America. So it's like, how do we bring out our richness and who we are to see, you know, the fundamentals that we have laid down for America is very powerful. And it's like, how do we tap into it and bring it back to its true essence? That's what I get from it.
Mr. Harris? Mr. Harris, are you there?
I was considering the fact that when it comes to American culture, the only true art, true music forms and all that stuff that wasn't copied from European art forms, all American culture is black culture, black and indigenous culture. You know, everything else comes from somewhere else. The only thing that was created here was for us, and for him to be able to recognize that at a point, because we have to understand that during the Harlem Renaissance, this is when all these little Tulsas and Greenwoods and all these things were, we were building ourselves up as a personal community. And all this stuff was happening at the same time. And it's a very powerful statement. You know, and it's just that I'm kind of upset that it's kind of fallen on deaf ears to a lot of people today. And we feel like assimilation or integration is our only goal that we need to work for now. We found out that we really set the culture in America, no matter what it is. We set the culture. And
yeah,
we need
that's true.
You know, and we need to understand that and use that to our advantage instead of letting other people take advantage of us.
Ms. Carter, you want to chime back in?
Yeah, no, exactly. Everything they said is very powerful. Yeah, sometimes we forget who we are because we take on other identities. Like you said, we are the essence. So if we're the essence, we need to act like it. We need to act like those kings and queens. And that's why I believe they portray us in such a manner that degrades us, because they know who we are. They know the power that we have. They know that as soon as we step into the plate, that it's going to be a shift. It's going to be a shift spiritually. It's going to be a shift mentally. It's going to be a shift physically, and they're trying everything in their power to stop us, but you can't stop it. You can't because God is in the midst, and we are the creation of God. So if we are the creation of God, you cannot stop us. And we have to become who we are. We need to tap into our souls of who we are and stop playing games and step into our greatness.
Okay. That sounds good. I want to take this moment to say the Quest Community Vibration live on 89.5 from the campus of Seton Hall in South Orange. And I want to remind everyone, all our listeners out there, that because of our current circumstances, we are doing our program outside of the studio for safety reasons. And I want to say also, I made a comment this week to a friend, and the comment just went simply like this. It's like some people are acting like there is no pandemic, like everything is normal, right? And the fact of the matter, the reality of it is everything is not normal. Everything is not right. And people are going through pain and suffering that we can't see. The whole idea of being able to go out on the town and mingle with friends, there might be people doing that, but it's not safe and it's not healthy, not at this time. And so that being said, I just wanted to remind the audience to bear with us, but more importantly, I want to thank the audience for listening to us and supporting our program, that we continue to press on and move forward, but do it in a safe fashion. And so that being said, again, we are Quest Community Vibration live on 89.5, and I want to turn it back over to our students, Walter Pierce.
Yes, and let's get into the second diamond of today, which will be Thurgood Marshall. And Thurgood Marshall was always cared about his fellow man. When he practiced law in Baltimore, Maryland, he represented many clients without getting paid. Thurgood graduated with honors from Howard University Law School. In 1940, he was named chief counsel for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. During his years with the NAACP, Thurgood and his staff won 29 out of 32 Supreme Court cases. His most famous victory came in the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. This historic decision overturned the separate but equal doctrine that had justified segregation since 1896. In 1965, Thurgood was appointed Solicitor General of the United States. When a vacancy occurred in the Supreme Court, President Lyndon Johnson nominated him for the seat. In 1967, this great jurist became the first black justice of the United States Supreme Court. Thurgood Marshall dedicated his life to protecting the rights of all Americans. And again, with Thurgood Marshall, him, you know, his upbringing and his unique aspect, and it was really with the justice system and him being a leader in the justice system, him fighting many cases that was in support of people, African American people, it was just an amazing journey how he was able to be an African American during that time period, and still be one of the people elected to the U.S. Supreme Court. And, you know, and he was able, he deserved that because of his multiple cases he won, which were huge, including the biggest case, Brown versus Board of Education. That case, you know, that really put Thurgood Marshall, I could say, on the map. And that told a lot of people about him and how great he was. And, you know, him being a part of this case and helping that was, of course, great. And, you know, just him later, just being so supportive of people, even being in this high justice system that is mostly of white Americans, him still knowing and still being a part with his people. That could sometimes be hard, you could say, for some African Americans. And the reason is, you know, when you get such a position that high, your thinking and your way of living could change being around these type of white Americans. So him still being with his people speaks volumes to the person he actually is. And you know, yeah, I have actually some things about Thurgood Marshall here. Some little facts about him, which is his first case with Charles Houston is the person's name, civil rights case. That was his first major win. The case was Murray versus Pearson. He wins first of 29 Supreme Court victories, including Chambers versus Florida. Marshall was named first director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And he wins Supreme Court victories in two graduate school integration cases, Sweat versus Painter and McLaurin versus Oklahoma State Regents. And those were all in the 1940s and 1950s. And then again, later on, 1954 is where he wins Brown versus Board of Education. So, you know, these just highlight a couple of cases he won. And again, if anybody has any comments or any information to add about Thurgood Marshall, the floor is open.
Well, I'm going to chime in right here, and I want to talk about two things. The first thing I want to talk about as it pertains to Thurgood Marshall, right, in the landmark case in Topeka, Kansas, all right, Walter, right, he fought. When you look at his life, he was not immediately granted access into law school, okay? I think it was one of the – I don't want to misname the university that would not allow him to enter. And how it was paid for with the family heirloom. His education was paid for, financed with a family heirloom. He had to overcome you know, all our programs – have one overwhelming theme, overcoming adversity. And in his own personal life, being turned away, rejected, he didn't just sit back and accept it. He stuck to his plan, and his plan became part of a larger plan that affected more people. The next thing I want to talk about is we find ourselves a lot from time to time, for lack of understanding of a lot of people, talking about black and white. Let me say this again. There is no white people. There is no black people. There is just one people. And there is a group of people who want to represent themselves as being better than others, other human beings. A group of people who act like that they are of privilege and look down on others. So I don't want anyone who's listening to this program to think that this is about black and white. And everybody on this panel understands that there is no black and white race. There's only the human race. And we talk about the ills of our society and how it is affected. But just for the sake of understanding, for those whose level, who have not completely leveled up so they can get the message, we use those terms, black people, white people. But no, it's human beings, okay? Now, that being said, I'm going to go straight to Mr. Harris because I need some help here.
No, on a higher level, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But the way our society is set up today, a lot of people don't want to take that next leap. So, like, they're kind of caught in the childhood stage. You know, that's when we teach kids the differences and stuff, and this color is this, this color is that. Just like in one of our first incidences is in Sesame Street. Because one of the first songs that I remember from Sesame Street was "Which One of These Things Is Not Like the Other?" And they were discriminating against things then on a really elementary level, but it was putting that mindset into your head so that you would start to look at things differently. And the people who are in charge, who understand that this is just a farce, they use these kind of techniques to keep themselves in a position in the world where they might not really be justified in being there. So I agree. You know, even Prince had even said something. He was talking about the rainbow children. You know, we're all part of the same. There's only one light, but if you look at it through a prism, it manifests itself in a lot of different ways. But without that prism, it's still just one thing. So we have to look at ourselves as that one thing, but until everybody does, nobody does.
And so when we look at Thurgood Marshall, he had to set apart his career to fight against these ills in society. What do you know, background information, to help Walter out about Thurgood Marshall that he didn't mention?
Well, Thurgood Marshall, he was almost like a test case, because he didn't become Supreme Court. You know, he was an excellent lawyer and counselor prior to becoming Supreme Court Justice. But we have to understand the time when he became Supreme Court Justice. This was right after the Civil Rights Act, right after the Voting Rights Act. He didn't become the Supreme Court Justice until 1967. And, you know, this is when, you know, when everybody was starting to feel that maybe we need to give these lowly Negroes a chance, but then they had to find somebody who was on a supremely high level on his job. And they just said, okay, well, we're going to pick him. Not that there weren't any other people of color that were qualified to do this, but because he was chosen first, it makes it look like he was above and beyond everybody else. But there were brothers that he worked with that were just as good, if not better than him. But he was the one that was chosen. And, you know, we have to look at those things. The same thing with Jackie Robinson. He wasn't the only good baseball player of color, but he was the first one to be able to get into the National Leagues. And, you know, and they put a lot of praise and stuff on him as if he was the best, and he wasn't. He was just the first. And we have to get out of this idea that being the first means you're the best. It means you were just chosen. Like a lot of things in this country, a lot of things are just, a lot of people and stuff are just chosen to be in first certain positions. I'm stop right there because I can keep going.
Okay. Tanisha, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
You want to chime in here on
either I guess I know, everything that was said. Yeah. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Hello. Yeah, yeah. So everything that was said was very powerful and is very on point, especially about the black and white. Because at one time, we wasn't considered black and white, and that was just within a decade or probably like two decades in, where they had, I guess, the structure of the color. Because at one time, Irish and Italian was considered black, and they realized that it was more powerful to put them as Caucasians because it gave Caucasians more, counts, if you want to say. So when we want to play the game of nationalities, you know, it's a game, because it's a game about numbers. That's the whole thing about the census, you know. And like I said, they know who we are, and we have to step into our greatness. And like you said, I guess many are called and few are chosen. And for the ones that are chosen, like you said, they choose to put them in those positions. But once you're in that position, you have a right to bring someone else with you. And that's the power that we have to remember. Like you said, you just cannot have one leader. It's many leaders. And then we also have to remember that we all have to come together as a unified front to be able to create these changes.
Okay. So I just want to reiterate what Mr. Harris said. We can have many leaders, but we need to stick to the plan. The plan does not have to ever change, but the leaders will come and go. Did I get that right, Mr. Harris?
That's it. Well, I got it from Dr. John Henry Clark. He said the same thing.
But people don't realize being a leader is not easy. Being a leader, you have to be a follower. You play a dual role. In order to lead, you have to follow, and you have to be sincere. You have to be humble. You have to be grateful. And that's what people don't realize. Being a leader, just because you think you're on top, it's not about that. It's about the people who are amongst you that creates that strong vibration. So I guess we get caught up in the European terms because everything is about, oh, being first. And it's like, no, it's about our indigenous ancestors who sat at the round table, who sat as, as a unit. You know, as a circle, because a circle is infinity. It means it's always interconnected, and that's what we have to be. We have to sit as a council, and I believe that's what we need to start going back to, sitting as councils, because councils, we could come together and agree to disagree, but it's always in a concise way versus one against another, because it comes back into unity. We have to remember, as they say, everything is ruled by signs and symbols, and they know that. You know, and then we have to tap back into who we are, because we know who we are, and we have to start playing these roles of who we are, and then things will change. The paradigm will shift, because you also got to remember that the universe has laws. You know, you have a universal law of polarity, and so that means you have negative and positive. So like you said, yes, we all connected as one human race, but you got to remember some people deal with that negative energy. And so how do you deal with people that deals with negative energy? The only reason why bad people flourish is because good people do nothing. So all the good people in all races need to come together to be able to create this change. And that's what we have to always happen. And that's when the adversities come or challenges come, because you always have that negative energy. And you always have to challenge that negative energy to be able to create that balance. And that's what we always have to remember, to keep everything in perpetual balance. So that means we have to fight. You got to keep striving. You got to keep hoping. Whatever you pray to for that strength, you know, and that's the things that we have to teach and keep teaching and teaching and teaching and uplifting. And that's how we're going to be able to create the shift that the universe needs.
Well, thank you. We definitely needed to hear that. And it was refreshing to be reminded that all of us, all of our people of any nationality must, and proper, well, lack of a better phrase, but forward-thinking people of all ethnicities be able to come together and create change, because that's what makes the difference in our society. Thank you for bringing that to the forefront. Now we're going to go back over here to our student host, Walter. Did you take it all in? Talk to us.
You know what? That was great of how y'all just continued the conversation and continue adding on information on the subject, talking about leadership. He's talking about a variety of different things that at the end of the day was all came down to one final conclusion. And you know, that conclusion just being us as people and us as we can't keep seeing ourselves and just saying race and keep separating ourselves based on this, because at the end of the day, there's only one race, as Mr. Bay says, there's only one race, and that is the human race. And I just want to thank y'all for adding on some information. But I have to continue, and the next segment that is going to connect these two people, Elaine Locke and Thurgood Marshall, today is my definition. And this segment provides the listener with words intervening so that we can achieve together a common basis to say we care and we believe in ourselves. Remember, whoever controls our definitions controls us. We must define existence and not have it defined for us. And the definition I picked today was the only definition and one of few definitions that could best connect these two people. And I came down to decide that I will use the word educator today. And everybody out there, you know what that educator means, somebody who teaches another person and informs another person. And the reason that best connects these two is because that's exactly what Elaine Locke and Thurgood Marshall did. Starting with Elaine Locke, you know, he was actually an English teacher at Howard University for a couple decades. He taught. That was his main thing, always teaching and informing people about our culture during the Harlem Renaissance. Taught about the musical aspect, the literal aspect, and just everything that dealt with the Harlem Renaissance, he talked about in his book, The New Negro. You could also say that he was somebody who always, in his writings, promoted key figures in the Black community, people like, again, Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. He was big on those people and just promoting people who fought for the struggle and was also a part of the Harlem Renaissance. That's what Elaine Locke did. And going to Thurgood Marshall, you know, his teaching was more, I guess you could say, kind of indirect, because, you know, he was doing these cases and fighting for these cases. But, like, while he was fighting these cases, it taught a lot of people about the current situation of America. He didn't directly teach it to them, but they started to get a teachable and understanding of what goes on and what these laws in America are and why these things need to be changed in America so that we could continue to progress. You know, again, Brown versus Board of Education is the biggest example, dealing with segregation mostly in education, segregated schools and all of that, you know, and people who probably heard and most likely heard of this case and followed the case if they was living during that time, they learned about the true situation of America dealing with education. And that was, you know, Thurgood Marshall's way of teaching. You know, he also I heard something, he also did reporting when he went to when he went to different countries. He talked about the treatment also of other people in other countries, the treatment of certain people. And, you know, he taught people as well. He taught about not just the struggles of Black people in America, but people all around the world. And that was Thurgood Marshall's way of being an educator. Thank you for listening. And also, before y'all chime in, you know, I gotta say this is Quest Youth Radio live on 89.5. And go ahead, take it away, Mr. Ben.
You don't know Thurgood Marshall's one of my heroes. One of. When he retired from being a Supreme Court justice, one of the issues that he fought diligently behind was the prison industrial system and the disparagement of the amount of blacks. Here we go again. Who were on death row. You know, he fought, and his attitude, his point of view was disparity between the number of blacks who were on death row in America as opposed to their white counterparts. And disproportionately, our people had been placed on death row more than their white counterparts. And that's still an issue today. When we talk about segregation in our public school system, that's still an issue today, prevalent. It is a problem, right? And we go over it as if, and earlier I mentioned the pandemic and people acting like, you know, there's nothing to see here. There's nothing wrong. Yes, it is wrong. And I'm screaming it out loud. But before we wrap this show up, let's go to North Carolina. Let's go to North Carolina, 1421. You want to have a comment, a question to our program today?
Yes, I enjoyed this program as always. All of the information that you gave and all of the comments, you know, they were just great.
Could you tell us your name?
Oh, my name is Colleen Rogers.
Well, thank you, Colleen, from North Carolina.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, so now let's go to Mr. Harris. No, we're on our way out the door.
So my final thoughts would be, just as Walter brought up the definition of the day as an educator, we got to understand that we need to be lifelong learners. And when it comes down to the exchange of information, we should always be open to those type of situations whenever they come up. And we can't discriminate about where we get our knowledge from, because sometimes we get the best knowledge from the most unlikely places. And I would just say that we need to continue to understand that it's not about being the educator, it's about being educated that really matters.
Okay. Val, our number one supporter, are you on the line with us this morning?
Good morning. We have less than 3 weeks to vote. November 3rd is our is election day, and 2 weeks from Tuesday is November 3rd. Please get out and vote.
Thank you. That was from our number one supporter, Val. We appreciate you, and we love you, and thank you for making your input. Tanisha, final words, keep it short. Do you have anything to say about today's program?
Research, do your own research, and use your inner spirit to guide you.
I love it. Walter Pierce, wrap it up, sir.
I would just like to thank everybody for tuning in to another edition of Quest Community Vibrations on 89.5. You know, we're not at the campus, but we're still here, and we're still going to run this show. So if everybody could say it with me, Quest Youth Radio is the best youth radio.
I think we got in there with an echo, too. Thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in to Quest. And make sure you tune in for our next episode next Saturday morning, from 7 to 8 a.m. on WSOU 89.5 FM. Thank you, everyone.